17, 1 Kings 17. If you have a Bible, I invite you to follow along with me. If you want to follow along and you don't have a Bible, that black book in front of you, page 348, you're welcome to follow along on that. And if all else fails, just pull out your smartphone and Google 1 Kings 17. This passage will come right up. Debbie read our verses this morning, and this morning for Mother's Day, I want to talk about knowing the presence and the power of God. And we're going to look at a story here in a minute or two where we see a mom struggling to provide for her children, kind of at the end of all her resources, and she's put in a very vulnerable position where she really has to put her trust and her faith in God in many ways. And through this experience with Elijah and watching the working of God in her life, she grows miraculously. And finally, at the end of the story, she says something pretty profound. Now I know that this is the true and living God. And what's happening in that passage is she is realizing the power in the presence of God. God has always been there. God has always been powerful. God has always been merciful. He's the one that created everything. And yet, maybe for the first time in her life, she's realizing the power in the presence of God. Well, I once heard somebody say this. You are only as happy as your least happy child. What do you think of that? You're only as happy as your least happy child. I trust that most parents under the sound of my voice will consider that to be true. In a 2011 article in the Journal of Gerontology, they tested this little proverb, and they wanted to know if the happiness in the life of a couple of your children might offset the unhappiness in the life of one of your children. And they ran a series of tests to see if that offset would take place. And the article says, to the researcher's surprise, the study discovered that success in one child does not overshadow the unhappiness in another. In other words, it's true. You can be 18 kids and counting, right? And yet if one of them is upset, if one of them's struggling in life, your heart really goes out to that child. It doesn't matter how many children we have. The truth is, we are usually only as happy as our most unhappy child. John Piper put it this way, a little bit shocking, but he said, to be a mother is a call to suffer. To be a mother is a call to suffer. Sounds kind of harsh at first, doesn't it? But the more you think about it, there's a lot of truth to that. Because when you become a mom or you become a dad, There's almost an enlarging of your heart. Your heart becomes larger, and you rejoice when your children rejoice, and you grieve when your children grieve. And that's true of all relationships, but that's really true when it takes place in the life of your children. And then you become a grandparent, right? And then it even doubles and compounds beyond that. And so Piper's right. To be a mom is, to some degree, a call to suffer. And it is true that you are only as happy as your most unhappy child. We can see this in several stories that we have in redemptive history. It's the story of Jacob and Benjamin in the Old Testament, where in the story of Genesis, the 11 brothers, they think Joseph is dead, the 11 brothers go to Egypt in order to find some food and some grain because it's a time of famine. And there they encounter Joseph. They don't know it's Joseph, one of their brothers, but they encounter him. And as you remember, Joseph kind of kidnaps Benjamin and keeps him and sends the other 10 brothers back to Jacob, their father. And it's such a dangerous mission that if we could be completely honest, even getting 10 of your sons back is probably a win in a culture like that. And yet Jacob doesn't stay there and rejoice because 10 of his children have returned. He's mourning the loss of Benjamin. Now, eventually, Benjamin returns. But there's an example where somebody standing there could say something like, hey, why don't you count your blessings, you know? Look at these 10 happy, healthy children you have. How insensitive that would be at that moment. But what does Jacob do? Jacob throws his hands up and says, the whole world is against me. And he laments and mourns the loss of Benjamin. Why? Because Jacob is only as happy as his most unhappy child. We think about Mary at the death of Jesus. And no doubt the rest of her children are doing fine, but there's a grief that's going through Mary's heart at that moment. In fact, it's prophetic because in Luke 2, Simeon says to Mary, behold, this child is appointed for the fall and rise of many in Israel. And then he says to Mary, and a sword will pierce your own soul. Think about that. A soul will pierce your soul. It's kind of interesting that Jesus is the one that hung and died on a cross, but even as a mom, Mary feels the pain to a degree of her suffering child. And I think every mother to some degree feels that. To be a mother is some degree a call to suffer. One of the Proverbs chapter 10 verse 1, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is grief to his mother. And so a mother hurts when her child hurts, and that's the story we see in the passage before us, 1 Kings 17, where the widow of Zarephath has a child, a son she's trying to provide for. We don't know where her husband is, probably died somewhere in the famine, and we'll talk about this in a minute. She's at the end of her resources, and in the end, she turns her heart to God and realizes the power in the presence of God. Now, every single thing in this story is extreme. Everything that takes place is extreme. And the arc of the story moves from extreme pain to extreme blessing. I want us to stand back on Mother's Day and kind of get into their world. Let's just enjoy this story for a little bit. Then we'll jump out and make some applications in our world today, okay? So watch the arc with me here in the story. We'll move movement by movement. The story begins with extreme conditions. I'm not going to reread all the verses. We'll just touch on them as we go. But verse 1 through 7, this is the beginning of Elijah's prophetic ministry. And Israel has broken a covenant with God. There's some kind of judgment coming on Israel. It's coming in the form of no rain. We're going to talk about this in a bit. But even more so, this judgment comes as Elijah withdraws from the covenant community. And verse 4 says that Elijah goes by the brook Cherith, where the ravens are going to feed him. Now here's the picture that God is giving Israel. Just as Elijah is absent from your community, my blessing and my favor is going to be absent from your community. As they've turned their heart on God, turned away from God, there's some kind of judgment coming on them in the form of Elijah, one of their main prophetic speakers, moving away and being absent for a season. And verse 7 says, the brook dried up. One of the judgments was no rain. And that, of course, brings about famine. And we're told about the effects that the famine had on Elijah, but in a little bit we get to the effect that the famine had on the widow. Famine in the ancient world was absolutely devastating. I don't think there's a one-for-one today. We can talk about famine in certain parts of the world, and there's a little bit of a parallel there. Certainly you that have traveled to third world and seen famine, you've seen what some of this looks like. But in many cases, there's some degree of resource coming in from the outside, but in the ancient world, it's like that, with nothing that could possibly come in. The effects of famine are devastating. People are fighting over the smallest morsel of food. Everything's dried up. Everybody's living hand to mouth. They're not saving up for tomorrow. All they have is what's in their hand at that moment. The widow here has about a third of a cup of flour in her hand here in the story. Crime goes through the roof. People routinely die in famine. There's laws on the books in the ancient world that in time of famine, if someone dies on your property, you're responsible to remove the body. That's how common death was in times of famine. In a book of Lamentations, you can see a famine that takes place in Jerusalem. And they result in eating things that we won't talk about on Mother's Day. I'm just pointing out the effects of famine drive people insane, whole communities insane. You ever seen a story or read a story about maybe someone or a group of people that are out to sea and there's no food and there's no water and they start hallucinating and they start thinking crazy thoughts? That's what happens in time of famine, only we're talking about maybe tens of thousands of people at the same time. The conditions here are extreme and they're absolutely devastating. Let's just note that. Now, I will say this. There are times in life when we bring about things into our life, and therefore we're having a tough time because of decisions we made, there are other times when you just feel like you're a victim of some macro things that are taking place, kind of like the famine here. The great thing about our God is we can call out to God regardless of one of those two conditions we find ourselves in. You know, if you read the Psalms, here's what comes to mind. If you read the Psalms carefully, David gives two different sets of Psalms, at least two, gives more. One little set is when he's running from Saul. And he's running from Saul, frankly, because he's done the right thing, and Saul is just out to get him. And he says things like this, Lord, I have not lifted my hand against the anointed, you know? He almost proclaims his own righteousness there. There's where David is feeling the effects, not of a decision that he's made, but a decision that somebody else has made. But you know, there's a whole different set of Psalms where David is running from Absalom. And when David runs from Absalom, it is because of decisions he's made in his life. Saul threw a spear at David. That had really nothing to do with what David did. But when Absalom is chasing David, David can no longer say, "Lord, I have not lifted up my hand against the righteous." No, what does he do? He pleads for the mercy of God. "My sin is ever before me. Have mercy on my soul." The great thing about our God is regardless of where we find ourselves, whether we find ourselves maybe feeling the effects of conditions and the fall in the world, not decisions we've made, but other people have made perhaps, or we're suffering as a result of our own bad decisions, all can call upon the name of the Lord. David models that for us in the Psalms. Extreme conditions move to an extreme situation. And that's where we get to the widow in verse 9. Elijah's first order of business is to go minister to the widow. Now we have to remember, she has nothing. We don't even know her name. Nameless, faceless, her husband probably died in the famine. Now the reason we can say with virtual certainty that she doesn't have anybody taking care of her is because in the ancient world, when your husband died, his family would normally come in and take up for you and at least provide for you. She doesn't have that here. It's not just true of Israel. It's true throughout a lot of the ancient world that if your husband died, you would marry who? You would marry his brother. Boy, that puts a whole new twist on choosing a spouse, doesn't it? You know, so if you pass, I get him, right? Okay, no, we're going to go to the next one. But that was a way to provide. That was a way to take care of people when people passed away. And so in a situation like this, we have a widow who has nobody caring for her, and that tells us possibly, probably, that even her husband's family is unable to provide for her. Next comes an extreme test. Oh, tough step to take here, verses 11 through 14. When Elijah comes, we are told, as she was going to get it, verse 11, she called, "Bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as your Lord God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take it home to make a meal for myself and my son that we may eat and we may die." Now, hospitality in the ancient world is a big deal. Hospitality is such that it was shameful to turn somebody like Elijah away in a situation like this. We even see in the story of like Sodom and Gomorrah where how important hospitality is. Jesus was received to some degree by the woman at the well. So in the ancient world, to refuse somebody when they're looking for your hospitality is kind of a shameful thing. Nevertheless, what's going on in this passage is so much more than just hospitality. This is a test, and that we know that because verse 12 says, "As surely as the Lord," notice the word Lord there, she uses the personal name of God. She knows some things about Elijah's God. She uses his personal name. "As surely as the Lord lives," she says, "I only have a handful of flour." This is not about will she provide for a traveler. It's about will she trust God? Will she trust God even under these extreme conditions? Is she willing to obey the voice of God, obey the voice of the prophet, even when she has very little herself? And so Elijah says, "Can I eat with you?" And she says, "I only have a handful of flour." Now, keep in mind, at this point, she's looking at the handful of flour thinking, okay, I can take that, maybe bake one little biscuit, and then we can divide it three ways. Maybe the traveler, Elijah, can have some, I can have some, my son can have some. But Elijah takes this test to the next level. Look at what he does in verse 13. He says, "No, I'm not looking to share with you." What does he say? Elijah said, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said, but first make me a small cake of bread." Now think about this. Elijah says to the woman, "You only have a handful of flour. I want you to go. I want you to make that. But, oh, make mine first." Okay, let's not make this one our life verse, okay? You're out today at Mother's Day, you know, and you say to the waitress, "We'll have all this, but make mine first." No, let mom go first today, okay? But you know, Elijah here is almost ramping up this test a little bit. And again, the point is this. The point is not, will you care for me as I travel? It's, will you put your faith in God? Will you make mine first? And you'll see God replenish this kind of supply, and it will never run dry. I believe every follower of Christ comes to this point at some time in their life. Will you obey me even in moments of desperation? Will you trust and will you follow me even when you feel like you're at the end of your resources? We see this with somebody like Abraham, where he's promised to have the child. He's promised that he will have the heir. And what happens? Abraham gets older in life, and he comes to the crossroads of, will he follow God in moments of desperation, or will he take matters into his own hands? And of course, he fails the test and take matters into his own hands. And that's where we get Ishmael in the story of Hagar. Moses comes to a point in his life where he's at the crossroads. Will he trust God in leading the people of Israel into the promised land, or will he take matters into his own hands? And in Moses' case, in very much like what we have here, we're talking about famine and lack of water, and Moses fails that test, and that's why he's not allowed to go into the Moses cannot bring people to the promised land because Moses is unfaithful at that critical moment. Now fast forward to the New Testament, and we have a similar story with Jesus, don't we? The true and living Moses, the true and better prophet, who in his moment of crisis, in Gethsemane and there on the cross, Jesus has to answer the same question. Will he entrust himself to God, even under these extreme and dire situations? Will he be obedient, here's Philippians, even unto the death of the cross? Jesus, unlike all those that came before him, passed that test. Where Moses fell short, where Abraham fell short, where David fell short, even where Elijah falls short at that critical moment, Jesus is the faithful prophet that can take us to the promised land. This is why the scriptures never glamorize prophets, kings, or priests in the Bible. They all point to the only one who made that right decision at the critical point, even unto the death of the cross. Then comes an extreme blessing. Verse 13 through 16, she steps out by faith, obeys the voice of the prophet. She discovers an endless supply of flour in the jar, and God provides for her every time she goes back. Boy, it reminds me of manna in the wilderness, doesn't it? Every morning they go out, there's manna on the ground. Every time she goes back to the jar, there's what? There's more flour in the jar. She reaches in, she bakes, she goes back. It's an endless supply. On Mother's Day, if there's one principle that moms and dads and all of us maybe should get our hands around, it's this. Little is much when God is in it. Little is much when God is in it. Sometimes we look at our resources. We have no idea how we're going to provide for our families. We have no idea how God will use something small in our lives. But little is much when God is in it. And that little third of flour is more than a storehouse. Because little is much when God is in it. I think about the little boy who brings the fish and the loaves to Jesus. Little is much when God is in it. We think about a significant, insignificant, small, weak Jesus movement at Pentecost. Has no power, has no gravitas in the world, has no political connections. But little is much when God is in it. And we see the expansion of the church and the expansion of the gospel. I go back to this. With Jesus, we have everything. Without Jesus, I don't care what our checkbook says, we have nothing. Little is much when God is in it. Next comes an extreme display. These verses weren't read. Verse 17, sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. She grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, What do you have against me, O man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son? Give me your son, Elijah replied. He took him from her arms and carried him to the upper room where he was staying and laid him on the bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, O Lord my God, have you brought this tragedy upon this widow that I am staying with by causing her son to die? Then he stretched himself out over the boy three times and cried to the Lord, O Lord my God, let this boy's life return to him. Elijah prays three times for life to be restored. You know, in the Jewish culture, you'll find this to be very common, especially in the ancient world, of praying three times. You know, there's a reason Paul, with the thorn in the flesh, remember what he said? I prayed three times for God to remove it. And then you find three temptations in the garden. And then the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus prayed, not my will, but thine be done. He prayed how many times? Three times. In ancient Jewish culture, it was assumed that you would pray for something three times, and if God didn't answer that prayer, it probably wasn't his will, but the best chance would be on the third time. Elijah kind of reflects that custom here as he lays over the son and prays for him three times. Verse 22, then the Lord heard Elijah's cry, the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child, carried him down from his room to his house, gave him to his mother and said, look, your son is alive. Wow, there's an understatement. Now, everything in this passage is flowing into verse 24. Then the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is truth. Listen to that language. Three words that sum up this entire chapter. Now I know. There's something in me that makes me say, where have you been for 23 other verses? But no problem. You know? Now I know. Through a series of things that are happening in her life that Elijah is doing, she comes to a point where she says, now I know. Now, what's happening when she says, now I know, is something in her is moving from the head to the heart. I mean, the truth of the matter is, we know all the way back at the beginning of the story, she knows a lot about God. She even uses the personal name of God. She knows apparently who Elijah is. She knows a little bit about this true and living God, enough to interact with some theological ideas and to know his personal name. But by the end of the story, the penny is dropping, and it's moving from the head to the heart. Now, here on Mother's Day, maybe we can think of it this way. If you, for you that are moms, grandmothers, remember when you were a little girl, you imagined what it might be like to be a mother? I don't know if you've did that. Maybe you pushed a baby around in a carriage. My little six-year-old does that. You might even look at other moms in the community or maybe at church, your aunts, and you thought, wow, that's what it's like. You could observe other people being a mom, and you imagine what that might be like. And you probably even got to the point where you felt exactly like what it would be. And then there comes a point on the baby's birthday, the birthday, right? When the baby's delivered and doctor takes baby and maybe lays babies in your arms. And then you say something like, oh, now I know. Now I know what it's like. There's something in the text going on like that, where the widow knows, but then she gets to the point where the penny drops, and she really knows. On Thanksgiving last year, I was up in Maine, in Portland, with my brother-in-law, and I love my brother-in-law. He's like a brother to me. And anytime your brother, you know, issues you a challenge, you're not going to back down. So he wants to do the polar bear plunge in the ocean there in Portland. And I thought, oh boy, you know, was it 40, 42 degrees? I like 80 degrees. He's going to do 40. And so he's like, you're going to do it with me? I'm like, of course I'm going to do that with you, you know? And, so it's funny, you know, you could watch a YouTube video of somebody jumping in a cold water. You can think about what it's going to be like. We even went to the ocean and I put my foot in and I thought, that's pretty cold, but it's not that bad, you know? And then we jumped in and we got out. And we looked at each other with that, oh, that really is cold. There's something about knowing and then really realizing what's taking place. That's what's happening in the life of this mom. She moves from all this head knowledge about God to a miraculous heart knowledge. Now I know that the word in your mouth is true. Now I know that this is the true and living God. And that's where God wants to bring every one of us, not just moms, dads, kids, all of us, singles. This is where God wants to bring us as people and as a church. How do we get there? How do we get there? Well, let's back up and kind of draw some principles that might help us. Let me give you a few thoughts on how the penny usually drops in our lives and we realize God's power and his presence. Let's start with this. Number one, I think we need to realize that every crisis presents an opportunity. And by that I mean every crisis presents an opportunity to seek God. There are different ways that things grow, right? Some things grow well in a greenhouse, like a plant, where it's a perfect environment, it's a gentle environment, and a plant grows. But not everything grows well in a greenhouse. We know that some things grow well in a gymnasium, like a muscle, where it's exercised, where it's stressed a little bit, where there's these little micro tears that take place, and then the muscle can come back and grow. I find it interesting that in Hebrews chapter 12, the concept of growth that's presented is not greenhouse, but gymnasium. In fact, we all know the word, I think we've used it here before, the Greek word is gymnasio, where we get the English word gymnasium. And so the author of Hebrews says that when crisis or trials come into our life, that's kind of like being in God's gymnasium. And what the widow here is experiencing is not greenhouse growth, oh no, it's gymnasium kind of growth, where she's being stretched, and her faith is being challenged, but as she perseveres, this crisis becomes an amazing opportunity for her to see God and really turn her heart to God. We know C.S. Lewis when he says things like, God whispers in our pleasure but shouts in our pain. Something similar here going on, where God is growing her, not through these perfect, sunny conditions in her life, but through a real challenge. When things come into our family, whether they're small little trials or really big trials, the very first thing we want to keep in mind is that every crisis presents an opportunity to seek God. And I can only tell you that me personally, not only as a pastor where I see and talk to people, but just in my own life, there is a huge difference between the posture that I take at the beginning of any trial. When a trial comes into my life and I think to myself and I pray, I'm going to seek God through this. I'm not going to let this crush me. I'm going to let this grow me. There's an amazing amount of potential for growth that can take place in our lives. But when that trial comes into our life, when we immediately think, I'm going to turn away from God, I'm not really going to seek Him in this, and we don't take advantage of those opportunities, it spirals off into the direction of unbelief. That's why the proverb wisely says, not the biblical one, the same sun that softens wax hardens clay. Same trial that comes into our life has the potential to really grow us in many ways, or it can crush us. And so, the very first thing we might say is that every crisis presents an opportunity. In fact, this bears itself out in the New Testament. It bears itself out throughout all of Scripture. I was thinking this week about how many times people came running to Jesus. I mean aggressively coming to Jesus. There are some that just bumped into Jesus. John 5, the Pool of Bethesda. A guy almost bumps into Jesus and he's healed of blindness. Doesn't even know who Jesus is. There's something pretty cool about that. But there's these other passages where people come up and they're not letting go of him, you know? Do you know how many of those it's a parent coming to Jesus on behalf of their child? Do you ever think about this? What about Jairus? Jairus, whose daughter is sick, he comes running to Jesus. You need to come to my house, Jesus. What about the man in Mark 9 whose son is possessed? And he comes aggressively running to Jesus. The disciples can't do it. He holds on to Jesus. I believe. Help my unbelief. What about that story? You know that story? We all know the story of the Syrophoenician woman because this is the story where Jesus says, she says, even the crumbs fall off to the dogs. Everybody kind of debates what that means. But what's really happening in that path? You know what's happening? That's a woman petitioning Jesus on behalf of her child. How many times in Scripture people run to Jesus and grow through that experience, taking their problems, their family problems, their emotional problems, their heartache over their hurting children to Christ. Every crisis presents an opportunity to seek God. Number two, when nobody seems to care, God does. In this passage, I don't want to pretend. This is a faceless woman. Nobody is caring for her. She has no help. If she has family, they're not helping. Her neighbors are nowhere to be found. She has nothing. We're talking about a single mom who is finding it incredibly difficult to make ends meet. No other family, low social standing, nobody cares. In fact, she says, I'm going to bake some bread, and this is going to prepare us for our last meal. I don't want to sugarcoat this and act like she's just refusing people's help, because it's nothing like that. She's a faceless person to the community. In her world, nobody cares, but God does. What does it mean that God sends Elijah to her? And keep in mind, God could have sent Elijah anywhere. He could have sent Elijah to the king. Could have sent Elijah to all the pretty people, to all the smart people. Could have sent Elijah to all the wealthy people, people that had a lot more flour and a lot more bread. But somehow in God's providence, he looks down and he finds what could be the most vulnerable, destitute person in this society. And he says, Elijah, I love how it says it in the text, go. That's the verb. Go to this woman. Go to this woman. She has something prepared for you and you have a ministry for her. Isn't it just like our God that the very first order of business in the prophet's life is to reach out to a widow that can't care for herself? Nobody in this community cares about the widow. Let's not pretend. But God does. Where am I going with this? Let me just put it this way. We would be unwise to speculate why God has allowed all this in the widow's life. For us to speculate that whatever he's trying to do, there are so many reasons that God allows trials and famines in the world and in life. We want to be careful not to overstep what we know. So I can't give you all the reasons that God has brought this into the widow's life, but this one thing I know for sure, it can't be because he doesn't care. And it can't be because he's indifferent. Because he sends his number one prophet, Elijah, to go to her house. It's almost like he looks down and says, Elijah, go here. Not here, not here, not here, here. Right to the house of the widow. Wow, do we have a lesson on mercy ministry here? But we need to move past it for the sake of time. When I think about this principle, that there are so many reasons that God may allow pain and suffering into our lives, but it can't be because he doesn't care. After all, he sent her Elijah. He obviously loves her and cares for her. Can't the same be said of Christ? Whatever reasons God allows things into our life, we can speculate, we can think about those. Some we know, some we don't. But it can't be because God is indifferent. It can't be because God doesn't care about us. Because God sent his son into the world. Just like Elijah breaks into the misery of the widow to minister to her, Jesus, the true and better prophet, breaks into the misery of our world and ministers and saves us. So the very first thing we can say, she can say, and we can say, number one, we seek God in the opportunity. Number two, whatever, when it feels like nobody cares, we know because he sent us Christ, God cares. God cares. Number three, when all feels lost, nothing is impossible with God. Nothing is impossible with God. What I love about this passage is it's, how do we say, it's who God defeats and where he defeats them. Okay, so just let's think about the story for a minute. There's two miracles. The first miracle is the flour, where there's the replenishing of the flour. The second miracle is the raising of the son from the dead. Now, in this culture, you have to remember, this is Baal culture. This is Baal country. Baal is the pagan god of fertility. Baal is responsible in this woman's mind and in everybody's mind. Baal is the one that makes it rain. Baal is the one that brings the flour. Baal is the one that makes everything grow. If you're pregnant, it's because Baal has showed some favor upon you. Baal is the god of fertility. What we have earlier in the story is Elijah rebukes the rain, not in the name of Baal, but the name of God. And when the rain stops, what is the author of Kings telling us? It's not Baal who's controlling things, it's who? It's God. And then he does this miracle in the name of Yahweh, and what happens? The flour is replenishing. What is that telling the woman? It's not Baal who's providing for me, it's the true and living God. Now, Baal is only one of the pagan gods in the ancient world. There are all kinds of them. Another one was named Mot. Mot is the god of death. Now, you have to understand, when it's not raining in the mind of ancient paganism, Mot has defeated Baal. Baal is submitting to Mot. The gods would act it out in heaven, then it would take place on earth. And so now, Mot is really taking over. No longer are things growing, things are dying, including her son. But then Elijah comes and raises this child in the name of who? In the name of the Lord. And what does she say? Now I know that your God is the true and living God. See, in her mind, she's making a movement from trusting Baal and trusting Mott to trusting the true and living God. That's the penny dropping in her life. And we can go a step further. Here's a step further. Not only is it show who God is defeating, it's where he's defeating them. This is Baal country. This is Mott country. And we're talking about geographical gods, right? This God controls this area. This God controls this area. Here's the question in everybody's mind. I know that God can do it in Israel, but can God do it in Sidon? Which, by the way, is Jezebel's hometown. What God does for the widow is he not only shows his power over all these forces, he does it on the away turf. Elijah is saying that our God not only wins on the home turf, he wins on the away turf. And he defeats anybody on the field. It's showing the strength and the power of God. We have to keep moving. Number four. Are we on four? I'm going to move real quick here. When we feel unable to provide for our children, we know that God has a plan for them. Let me give you a thought. A thought is this. Number one, God cares. We talked about that, right? And number two, he is able. He loves us, and he's powerful. And if we believe those two things, number one, we're not going to be deist, right? We're not going to think he's powerful but doesn't love us. We're not going to be secularist either. We're not going to believe he loves us, but he's not powerful. When you believe God loves you and he cares, then we can believe this right here, that we can trust God with our children. Just one thought on this. Every mom comes to a point where you have to let go of your child. You just have to. And sometimes it's small things, right? Like letting them go to the school bus, you know? Sometimes it's really big things, things that scare us. And yet, we can trust God with our children. I love the story of Moses, where Moses is put into that little basket and he's floating, you know, floating on the sea. And then you can see the currents in the water taking Moses right where Moses needs to go. And then a daughter of Pharaoh picks him up. And then she goes and find a nurse to nurse the baby. Happens to be Moses' mother. You couldn't make this stuff up. This is an amazing story. There comes a point in every mom's life where it may not be putting a basket in the river, but you've got to get your hands off for something. And if we believe he's able and we believe he loves us, we can believe that he has a plan for our children. Last point is this, and we see this in the resurrection passage. When we feel that we are at the end, God always has more. He always has more. This little picture of the resurrection of Elijah raising the boy from the dead, what is that? That's a small commercial of what God will someday do for those who love him and those who put their faith. It's a small commercial. That's all it is. In fact, this child someday died again. There's a true and better resurrection that awaits, which reminds us, whatever happens in this world, it's not the final story. It's not the end of the story. Small sample. This resurrection is a small sample that points to a greater resurrection. I was with Costco's with my family yesterday, and when you got kids at Costco's, it's great because they're samples. And they walk around and get little snacks and things like that. And then you go to a food court and they're so full they barely eat. You think about a sample at something like Costco's. It's a small little taste of an aisle that's loaded with all that stuff. You know, the resurrection, when he raises this boy from the dead, it's a small picture of a true and better resurrection that awaits his people and awaits our children. You know, whatever happens in this life, it's a reminder that God has glorious plans awaiting all of us who believe in him. Every crisis presents an opportunity. When nobody cares, God does. With God, nothing's impossible. We can trust God with our children. And let this resurrection be a picture of the glorious plans that God has stored for us and those that love him.